Accession number 23329, reel 17.
Cal Younger, reel 17.
At Turin, which was Stalag 357, the camp leader was a regimental sergeant major, and the room leaders were all the most senior NCOs. The army men certainly had never dreamed of electing their leader, and of course in all the officers' camps throughout Germany, the senior British officer was automatically the leader. It often meant that the group captain was leader for a fortnight, and an air commodore arrived to take over. Anyway, in 357, Dixie Deans remained the RAF man of confidence, but took second place to Regimental Sergeant Major Turner. The soldiers, when they addressed people or referred to somebody they didn't know well, used rank, which was something we never did, but I quite liked it because it did introduce a note of courtesy into camp life. And even the Australian soldiers, who reputedly were not very amenable to military niceties, were quite punctilious in this. Paradoxically, there seemed to be a greater sense of almost brotherhood among the RAF, which may have stemmed partly from the closer confinement to which we'd been accustomed, and in part perhaps to a more rigid policy of not fraternizing with the Germans. But most of all, I think, it could be attributed to the common loyalty to Dixie Deans. It was he who inspired this unity, which was really quite something, with so many individual personalities not really conforming to a military style of discipline. We had more freedom in the camp than we were used to, but parades were much more disciplined, I suppose, much more so than under the Luftwaffe. The huts were not locked at night, and this was the summer, of course, so Kriegers often took their blankets and slept outside. They were relying on information that the dogs were harmless. However, soon after we arrived, an airman was shot dead at point blank range by guards one night. We never knew whether he was trying to escape or whether he was just wandering around. Sleeping outside had already more or less ceased because the dogs had proved rather less sympathetic than had been supposed. We reckoned that that was because the Heidegrub dogs had been added to the force. I forgot to say a small consignment of Red Cross parcels arrived at the station, and men were sent to unload them, and they claimed that they saw Hitler go through the station in a special train. And the following day we heard of the attempted assassination of Hitler, the bomb plot near Rastenburg in East Prussia, the 20th of July plot, as it became known. We knew nothing of the terrible fate of the conspirators, but there was a very curious aftermath of the incident. The Nazi salute was introduced instead of the Orthodox military one on parade. Dixie resisted an attempt to compel us to use the outstretched hand, and it was agreed eventually that we should salute in our way and that the Germans would respond with their own salute, the Nazi salute. At this time we became aware of the existence of an ingenious machine called the blower, something that we had never had up to this point. The principle was something like that of the blacksmith's forge. It was a wooden base about, do you want this? It was a wooden base about 2 feet in length, and on that was mounted a wheel which was cut from wood, and it was grooved to take a belt which then was connected to a spindle. The wheel turned and the spindle rotated a fan which forced air through a vent in the clay-lined tin which contained wood chips, and burning fiercely it would boil a Dixie in just about a minute. Most economical thing I ever saw, I think. We were quite adept in removing rafters and beams which had been considered essential in the construction of the buildings, but which we proved were not, though I don't think there was a hut in the camp that would have withstood a high wind. And even the thickness of the floorboards was reduced by half, all to feed the greedy blowers. Even a small latrine, which in a rather isolated position and probably been used by workmen when they were building the camp, that disappeared altogether. And one of our musicians, a trombonist, on his way to band practice, trying a trill or two on the way, failed to notice that where there had been a building, there was none now. And he stepped into the pretty awful pit and took his trombone with him. An army band played every Sunday, and in Poland there seemed to be a habitual Sunday afternoon walk, and there was a main road from Thorn running past the camp, and so the local population used to stroll past the wire to watch the human zoo and presumably to listen to the band. We were entertained by the traffic, and we stood near the wire to watch what the promenaders were doing outside. Occasionally a girl would flick a note through the wire and walk quickly on, and we did hear that before our arrival a girl who tried to throw a message to a Polish soldier was shot dead. But some of the Poles among us actually had relatives in the passing crowd. The result of this was that the Poles were led from the camp in handcuffs, and they were convinced that they were going to be executed. Deans protested, and he persisted in agitating for their return. He was eventually informed that the men were incarcerated at another camp at Mühlberg, and he did receive a note from the Polish leader. One Sunday afternoon there was a sudden thunderstorm, and it sent prisoners racing for soap and towels. Now the thing was that to take a shower in that camp, one needed to be pretty hardy. The water came from deep wells and was bitterly cold. Every drop had to be pumped. You stood beneath a wooden sluice box, removed the stopcock, and there was a fierce gout of water, and you didn't stay very long. The queue kept moving rapidly, but the rain was a different matter, and that was nice and soft and not too cold, so people enjoyed their showers in the rain, although at one point a lorry loaded with girls went past the fence, and there was a fair bit of quick covering up. Opposite side of the road from the camp, there was an area of wasteland, of sand dunes and gorse, and it was used for manoeuvres by the German army. They were mostly training elderly men, because the Germans were dipping pretty deep for manpower at this time. And we enjoyed watching the veterans crouching behind bushes and crawling on their bellies. They seemed almost like children playing at soldiers than the real thing. But it certainly was the real thing. And all day long we heard the crash of mortar fire, and there were flights of Focke-Wulf 190s patrolling the Vistula, presumably looking after the bridge. And we could see vapor trails in the sky, which went vertical and at fantastic speed, and occasionally we got a gleam of something. Every day in the German news there would be the phrase retribution fire continued on England, and men were receiving news of the deaths of relatives, and what it was the V1. But what about the vapor trails? In fact, what we had witnessed were final trials of the V2. For the first few days at Thorn, the RAF kept secret the existence of the canary. They weren't sure whether it was safe to open up to another 3,500 men. However, after conferring with the senior army NCOs, the RAF men decided to get the canary going again, and so the shorthand writers, Mogg and Ainsley, took down the news, and the corps of readers began their rounds again. They now included army men. Army journalists produced a war newspaper called Time and Tide, which was more elaborate than the Daily Reco or any other war newspaper that we had attempted. It ran to 9 sheets of articles, short stories, news columns, and all beautifully hand-lettered. And there were also original cartoons in colour. It seemed incredible that each day so much work went into the production of a newspaper, of which there was just one single copy. I remember particularly a cartoon which was supposed to be a post-war scene of a lot of hens sitting on a rail, and the man and his wife gazing at them, and the wife asking, why do they remind you of Thorn? Whether the man explained the 40-holer to her, I don't know. Another feature of the army camps that we hadn't had before were swap shops. The proprietors were the barrow boys of the camp. They were purely commercial, but they did have quite an entertainment value. The proprietors worked on commission, both vendor and purchaser being charged, and the swap shop men bought and sold food, clothing, blowers, boots, soap, razor blades, watches, musical instruments, books of every kind. It was like Petticoat Lane. Yes. There were even metal ribbons which were cut from toothbrush handles, and they were bought by the old regulars who felt undressed without them. Most of the swap shop men had German contacts, and they obtained civilian bread and lighter fuel and other items for which they were sure of buyers, and they did outlay their own cigarette capital on these. They did earn their money, they worked long hours, and they were quite skilled, and they could often sell things that the average prisoner would never have succeeded in doing. Many prisoners were convinced that the war would end before the winter, or anyway. The Russians were rolling along at such speed that the Germans were bound to retreat, and we couldn't see any reason for their trying to take us with them. There didn't seem to be any point in their retaining us. These were very much the thoughts we'd had at Heidekrug, and the result of that had been a transfer to Toren. Now, we were on the way again. For some reason, the Germans still wanted us. And on the 8th of August, we left the Stalag 357, although, in fact, we took the number with us to Fellingbostel in western Germany. One thing that I remembered to this day, during the 3 weeks only that we were at Toren, there was a notice pinned up by the Germans which read, "At 9 a.m. this morning, Flying Officer Adams was executed at Toren Fortress." I've often wondered who Flying Officer Adams was and why he was executed. Germans had quite a job to count 7,000 or so men as we left Toren camp, and at the end of several counts they found they had 3 men too many. They had forgotten the 3 men who had hidden in the beginning of a tunnel at Heidekrug. They had gone after we had marched from the camp, but they'd all been picked up and sent to Thorn. But the Germans had forgotten to add their names to the list. So although we could have told the Germans what had happened, we let them sort it out for themselves. Even though we were standing there on a very oppressive day with our packs on our backs, and but soon the Germans decided that matters could be sorted out at our destination, and so the order to march was given. We were allowed a rest twice, and we lay with our packs as backrests. We smoked and just listened to the sounds of summer. We could have forgotten the war almost, but for the blasting of the mortars and those white lines of the V2s streaking upwards. It's a sad stream of refugees moving to some unknown destination far away. It was all so very old, really. The oxen pulling the clumsy old carts with bedding and chairs, kitchen utensils, the women shawled, and the men just smoking, usually short-stemmed pipes. They were just resigned. We too felt that we were the unwanted backwash of the battle. We suffered to live because humanity, though enfeebled, was not yet dead. We had value only as hostages. Once in Torn, we marched to the station, and it was a long time before we were ordered to climb into the 8-horse, 40-men cattle trucks. In fact, they still had a covering of straw and manure. While we waited, we watched the people of the town going about their business, and they watched us. There were some blonde Polish girls who, at any rate at that time, seemed to us to be startlingly beautiful, and they appeared to be chatting earnestly, but they were watching us. The guards did not bother about them. In fact, they were quite amused and had some crude witticisms to say, I gathered. I didn't speak German. So it was on to Fallingbostel. It was the second time in a month that we were being moved by the Germans ahead of their own retreat, and we were suddenly very optimistic, and we thought of this journey as a prelude to liberation, which I suppose it was, though it didn't come quite as soon as we hoped. Nobody really wanted to escape at this point. We would be too soon free for that. The guards, on the other hand, seemed resigned to defeat, and they were more lax than they'd ever been before. In fact, on some occasions when we'd been allowed to alight for to meet the calls of nature, the train started before we were finished, and people ran after the trucks to get aboard, and in one case the guards of one truck failed to get aboard in time, and they handed up their rifles to the prisoners and were helped up. Two Kriegies were left in a outbuilding near the railway, and they could have stayed there, but they came running out, and the train was stopped for them. Earlier, that would have been unheard of. People would have been hairing off into the countryside as fast as possible. At Bromberg, in our truck, we persuaded the guards to let us down onto the track, and Dick and I were talking to some French prisoners who were working on the railway, when the officer in charge of the train roared up, ordered us back, swore at the guards, and sent them in disgrace to the rear of the train. He put the corporal in charge under arrest, and six more guards arrived to take charge of our truck. In the next truck, Kriege found that the tin of tea he had was undrinkable, and he put his arm through the barbed wire cage and held the tea out of the truck. Unfortunately, the angry officer caught the lot and stood with the tea dripping down his immaculate uniform, clinging to his moustache. It has to be said that he saw it was an accident and just turned away.